A child refuses food for 3 days after Yom Kippur. She finds strange pride in saying no, a small act of control in a chaotic world. Within days, she's hospitalized and diagnosed with anorexia nervosa, a term she's never heard before. At 6 years old, she becomes perhaps the youngest person ever given this label. This moment marks the beginning of a lifelong inquiry. What happens when a diagnosis becomes the story of who we are? Rachel Aviv's journey through psychiatric wards as a child opened her eyes to how quickly illness identities take hold. She met 12-year-olds who taught her sophisticated avoidance techniques: never sit down, do jumping jacks at night, stay constantly in motion. She learned to read standing up and developed elaborate food superstitions, refusing even to say 8 because it sounded too much like 8. One girl, Hava, embraced her diagnosis with unsettling enthusiasm, writing that psychiatric labels give you a title to live up to and an identity. Those exclamation marks betrayed both excitement and desperation in finding a framework for understanding oneself. Years later, investigating resignation syndrome among refugee children in Sweden, Aviv recognized familiar patterns. These children, facing deportation, became completely unresponsive, unable to eat, drink, or acknowledge the world. Like anorexia, this syndrome followed cultural scripts for expressing distress, with children embodying powerlessness through the few forms of protest available to them. Philosopher Ian Hacking called this the looping effect. People get caught in self-fulfilling illness narratives that fundamentally alter their possibilities for being. The diagnosis becomes not just description, but prescription, shaping behavior and identity. Aviv's narrow escape from a lifetime of illness made her uniquely attuned to critical early phases, the period before diagnoses become fixed aspects of identity. When does a helpful framework for understanding distress become a self-fulfilling prophecy? The timing and duration of psychiatric intervention may determine whether a diagnosis becomes a temporary tool for healing or a permanent aspect of who we are. In 1979, Ray Osheroff paced Chestnut Lodge Psychiatric Hospital for 8 hours daily, walking 18 miles in slippers until his feet blistered. His psychiatrist believed Ray's obsessive regret masked deeper denial. The lodge, resembling a southern plantation, represented the pinnacle of psychoanalytic treatment. Its founder insisted pharmacology has no place in psychiatry, while renowned analysts lived on the grounds, sometimes taking patients to lunch or imitating their posture to understand their perspective. Ray had embodied the American dream, a charismatic physician who opened 3 successful dialysis centers. But after selling part of his business, he sat in his car and realized, "I had become a piece of wood." His depression deepened until threats of suicide prompted an ultimatum: hospitalization or lose everything. Despite months of intensive therapy, Ray deteriorated. His wife filed for divorce, his ex-wife restricted visitation, and his clinic position hung by a thread. Disillusioned, Ray's mother transferred him to Silver Hill, a hospital that embraced antidepressants. Within 3 weeks of medication, Ray experienced a breakthrough, realizing his prior state hadn't been grief, but a total absence of feeling. Ray's transformation became the foundation for a landmark lawsuit against Chestnut Lodge. Though Ray settled for $350,000, the case fundamentally changed psychiatric practice. Even the lodge began prescribing medication to nearly all patients, marking the end of an era. Bapu left her family in 1970 to pursue spiritual devotion, leaving biscuits and chocolate for her children with a note: "Be smart, many kisses." When police brought her home, a psychiatrist diagnosed schizophrenia at a glance. The schizophrenic has no insight. She doesn't know who she is. Western psychiatric frameworks couldn't grasp Bapu's experience, rooted in Hindu mystical traditions. Indian psychiatrists noted that Western psychology failed to comprehend how mystical quests pervade and inform life in its deepest layers. Indian healing traditions aimed to raise the self to a higher ideal, a fundamentally different conception than statistical normality. Her family suspected supernatural forces and invited priests who declared the house haunted. Bapu rejected this as stupid, insisting her poems and prayers flowed only with the blessings of God. She grew strategic about escaping to temples, where intense religious behaviors went unchallenged. In her journals, she described mystical experiences while acknowledging, "If I mention all this, you all will think to send me straight to Kilpak Hospital." Though yearning for transcendence, she remained tormented by separation from her children. In 1978, a psychiatrist forcibly sedated and hospitalized her. After discharge, she disappeared, only to be discovered 5 years later living as a beggar near a temple. On July 4, 2003, Naomi Gaines attended the Taste of Minnesota celebration with her twin boys. Feeling isolated in the predominantly white crowd and perceiving hostility everywhere, she dropped her twins into the Mississippi River and jumped after them, shouting, "Freedom!" Only one child survived. Naomi grew up in Chicago's Robert Taylor Homes, where 99% of residents were Black and 96% unemployed. Her family survived on welfare, cycling between having food and going hungry. Her mother fled to Minnesota, believing it offered better social services. 3 years earlier, Naomi had attempted suicide. Hospitalized and diagnosed with adjustment disorder attributed to being a single mother working two jobs, she was prescribed medication but stopped taking it, believing pills couldn't change the heartache in the world. Her family trusted prayer over medical intervention. We trust an invisible force more than we trust doctors who haven't proven they have our best interests at heart. After giving birth to twins, Naomi's mental health deteriorated rapidly. She became paranoid, believing she'd gained special insight to cure racism through music. Though she wanted to plead insanity, doctors concluded she didn't meet insanity requirements because her delusions stemmed from astute observations about society, the first time her perspective on racism had been institutionally validated, only to be used against her. She accepted an 18-year plea deal. Laura Delano, descended from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, excelled outwardly yet felt hollow inside. When she began cutting herself at 14, a psychiatrist diagnosed bipolar disorder during an era when such childhood diagnoses had surged 4,000%. Laura felt relieved. It was like being told, "It's not your fault." Starting on Prozac, she entered a prescription cascade, taking medications to counteract side effects. At Harvard, she withdrew socially and experienced sexual disconnection as medication side effects mounted. After a suicide attempt at 25, doctors diagnosed borderline personality disorder, a label that felt accusatory. Reading psychiatric medication critiques, Laura questioned her 14-year history on 19 different drugs. Learning the chemical imbalance theory lacked biological markers, she decided to stop. Withdrawal brought hypersensitivity to light, excessive sweating, dizziness, and constant buzzing under her skin. 8 months later, Laura experienced sexual desire for the first time. At 31, her first orgasm brought tears of triumph. Her story reveals how medication intertwines with identity. Discontinuing means confronting a new self where everything that you are doing is yours and not necessarily your medication. 3 decades later, Aviv reconnects with her childhood doctors. When she mentions admiring a girl named Hava, they become uncomfortable. Hava had recently died. Unlike most former patients who distanced themselves from their illness history, Hava had embraced her identity as someone with mental illness. Hava's journals contained meticulous exercise plans and anthropological accounts of hospital life. Despite deep self-awareness, she wrote, "I thoroughly understand myself, yet am a stranger to myself." At 31, after her insurance expired, she moved into her father's condominium. On April 11, 2019, Hava was found unresponsive, having asphyxiated after vomiting in her sleep, her esophageal muscles weakened by years of bulimia. Through these stories, Aviv explores how mental illness narratives are shaped by culture, race, gender, and economics beyond individual biology. Bapu's daughter founded an organization offering counseling that acknowledges both neurological and spiritual dimensions. As Naomi explained, "Your mental break could never be my mental break. We have different fears than white people." What emerges isn't a rejection of psychiatric categories, but a call for culturally informed approaches. The most helpful perspective maintains multiple frameworks simultaneously, acknowledging both scientific validity and personal meaning-making. The question isn't whether to use psychiatric frameworks, but how to hold them lightly enough that they illuminate rather than imprison.